Hello, how are you? It's Darragh O'Brien here. This is episode 6 of the RTE Rugby Podcast, available on rte.ie, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts. And of course, we like to be contacted, Twitter at RTE Rugby or Facebook /RTE Sport. A little bit later, we'll have some audio snapshots from the Ireland camp for you. We'll hear from Rob Kearney. We'll also speak to former Munster player and the current Stade Francais attack and backs coach Mike Prendergast. Later on, we'll hear from Emer Considine, the Irish winger. And we are also going to be chatting to Simon Thomas about Operation whatever it's called in Welsh regional rugby. Anyway, with me in studio, against the head producer Wes Liddy and Michael Glennon from the online sports desk here in RTE Sport. Let's get going with the squad selection. That's fresh to hand. Sean Cronin is the headline, I guess, is it?
Appears to be. That just came in just before we came to studio, and it's Sean Cronin, who Joe Schmidt had talked up about, you know, not judging a player on one bad performance, and with Rob Herring has been included, and Niall Scanlon and Rory Best obviously ahead of him, so I'm sure he won't be happy with that, but he got to play his way back into it, and that's still a possibility. And Henshaw left out. That was kind of flagged up, that his recovery from a dead leg wasn't going to plan.
The other injuries seem to be coming along, but his one has taken a setback. What else on team selection was there, our squad selection?
Well, I suppose just to go back on Cronin, whether it's harsh or not is a different conversation, I suppose, in that, like, obviously hooker's one of those positions sometimes where your mistakes are very clear for all to see, but doesn't really tally up with a lot of what we've heard about getting the show back on the road and, you know, confidence and all the rest of it, to kind of just bin a guy like that. I always remember back to seeing him playing for Shannon against Clontarf as a 19-year-old in the AIL final and catching a winger from about 10 yards to prevent a try. And I remember seeing him at 19 and thinking, just this guy's going to go wherever he wants in the game. And it sounds funny for a guy with maybe 3 European Cups to be saying it, but there's always, for me, a little bit of a sense of kind of unfulfilled potential with him, and unfortunately maybe this is an indicator that that'll continue to be the case.
So it's a bit of a mystery.
Well, it's not a mystery insofar as his last performance, but I mean, he just hasn't been, I don't know, he's fallen into the impact replacement category a little bit. But
he is the best of those, isn't he, that we've seen?
Yeah, but I mean, New Zealand don't pick Dane Coles as an impact sub just because he's a good ball carrier, you know. So, I mean, I don't know. I feel for the guy, to be honest.
What's the weak point of his game, so?
Well, I mean, the word would be that Rory Best is a stronger scrummager. And obviously the darts can be hit or miss at times, which is a big thing. But, you know, you're just wondering, we'll talk to Prendy about it. I know they're not as happy with their academy structures in France, but when you get an athlete like that, the things he can do are things that you can't teach in terms of his acceleration, his explosiveness. Yes. So you'd like to have thought that over the 10, 12 years of his professional journey, the kinks and technical things could have been fixed.
Through repetition, if nothing
exactly.
else.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, it's an interesting squad. I think, just on the back of the performances of the last few weeks, it'd be interesting to see where Dave Kilcoyne figures in this. I mean, he played very well the last day. Tadhg Burns, a lot of people are mentioning that he might bring a certain energy to things. Does CJ Stander come straight back in? Who's first choice at 7 at this point? Will it be O'Brien or Van der Fleer? So there's lots of little nuggets there to talk about.
Ross Byrne also back in. So there's 4 out halves in that squad. And maybe, as Wes said before, that could be to cover Joey Carberry if he's still not 100%.
Let's talk to Prendy. Good morning, Michael.
Morning, guys. How are you?
I'll speak for everyone. We're all in outstanding form. How's things over there?
Great. All good. No, not too bad, thank you. Not too bad. Finished a few hours of training and a small break now, so good to catch up.
As luck would have it, I met a pal of mine for a cup of coffee this morning, and he has a pal who's a French lad who's mad into his rugby, and he was saying, Mike, that he said, oh well, you know, we got dismantled versus England, this is the French national team, he said, but they have 5 full-time video analysts, we only have 3 part-time. And he said, you know, he's kind of buying into the thing now that there's no chance of success until they get the boring stuff out of the way. Is that happening?
I don't know. It's going to be, you know what, it's going to be an interesting game. Obviously there's, I suppose, from 2 camps, there's been a lot looked at. Ireland, obviously, after the performance, I think it's there was a huge focus on the performance against England, losing your first game at home, and Obviously, the two games afterwards, I suppose, haven't been to where we expect them to be. And I suppose from this side over here, with the French team, you just don't know. You know, you look at a performance, I suppose, against Wales in the first half in tricky conditions. I thought they played some good rugby. And the thing is with them, when they're down and everybody is kind of against them at the moment, they can become a tough animal. But I do think that Ireland will look to come out and they look to really ask questions of them. I think they're, you know, France in terms of if you ask questions of them defensively, if you hold on to the ball, get into a lot of multi-phase facet game, I think that's what Ireland will do, and they'll pose a lot of questions. They look to frustrate the French by holding on to the ball. And I suppose from the other side of it, the other side of the ball, that's where the French can be quite dangerous, is their open field stuff, is they're unstructured, they're counter-attack, so when Ireland kick, they need to kick accurately. That's where their strength is. I suppose they're kind of like, they're nearly based on how Toulouse do it, but Toulouse do it better, as obviously not at an international level, at a level below a club level, but from counter-attack and also from turnover. So Ireland will be very, very aware of that's where their danger is. But I think also it will allow, if Ireland go out with that mindset, and I'm not saying they're going to throw the ball around, I think they'll play quite close, but just go through a lot of multi-phase and frustrate and outwork France. So it's going to be a real interesting tactical game as well, you know.
It's interesting there, Wes, too, the way Prendy sets it up. It's almost neutral would be rooting for France. Like, it's our discipline and ball control and strangled possession versus a suffocating game versus potential flair.
Yeah, how are you, Prendy? You well?
Good, Wes.
Good, good. Come here, I was just wondering, obviously you'd be keeping up with the talk that's been here over the last few weeks and all this talk of confidence and the rest within the Irish camp. And there was a column by Johnny Holland this morning I saw where he's saying a coach is kind of trying to find a balance between being positive with the players but maintaining high standards that comes with maybe a bit of criticism at times. How would you handle the Irish team over the last few weeks? Would your response be to kind of ease off and put the arm around the shoulder, or would it be to double down on the work and training? How would you approach a dip like that in form?
I think it's a bit of both as well. And, you know, you really need your leaders. Because at the end of the day, you know, the coaches give a menu, they coach. But at the end of the day, you cross the white line and it's the players, it's the leaders, it's the tactical decision makers that, you know, that drive it. So I think there's a balance. Obviously, confidence is down a small bit, you know, just from the outside looking back, rugby's gone to where it was a number of years back. It's massively popular at home. Everybody is speaking about it because Ireland have been so successful. So everyone's got in behind us. I suppose our standards have been so high over the last number of years. And then through the Six Nations, albeit when you look at it, Ireland have, through injury and through, you know, Joe is looking at it, I suppose, to pick his best 30 as well for the World Cup. So there has been a bit of change in the team. You've the likes of Connor and Johnny, who probably haven't a huge amount of rugby under their belt. You can say they've one or two games, but when you come up international rugby, it's another step up, you know. So you have a bit of that going on. Obviously, confidence is a bit obviously down because, you know, after the England game, everything was focused on, everything was picked on. And, you know, they're humans at the end of the day. They do hear this, they do see it. I know people, a lot of players might say, I don't look at it. You do hear it. So I think that got to them, and you could see it in the performance, especially against Italy, you know, when they were trying to get in off, you know, power plays, we'll call them, that Joe Schmidt sets up, that he sets up brilliantly, that Ireland have scored against New Zealand, against Scotland, really intelligently by, you know, having a three-phase play and picking out that weakness. And I think that's something that Joe will do definitely this week, because knowing his experience with the French team as well, I think that's something that they'll put a big focus on. But I suppose against Italy, we probably came up short there. There was a couple of, you know, when they're trying to start those starter players, there's a couple of loose passes that hit the ground, knock on, and it just, you know, it took the momentum out of them, and Italy, sorry, grew on that, you know. So I think this week will be a real focus on getting a real good start to the game, like in every game, but especially I think this week for Ireland playing at home. But the question is, Wes, you're asking me, I think it's a balance. I think, you know, you've got to look at the stuff that needs to be improved. You've got players to drive it, and Ireland have those. Ireland have incredible leaders. They've incredible experience. Rory Best, Connor, Johnny, you know, CJ, Peter Manning, you go through them all. There's so much experience, international experience. And I think, you know, with the staff and with the players they have, they'll find a solution, I've no doubt. And I think it'll come good this week, personally. And next thing, the you know, the car's back on the road and everyone is humming and the confidence comes back. And the other thing is, let's not forget, as I said, through injuries, through a bit of rotation, you know, you mentioned there earlier that Sean Cronin isn't on the bench. I'm sure he wants to look at...
What do you think of him not being in the squad after one, after...
I think Sean Cronin's one of the, in world rugby, one of the best men you can bring off. You always look at, you look at, the game is a 23 man now, you look for those subs to make a difference. Sean Cronin, okay, some people might say with his throwing or whatever, but I think any time he comes off the bench, there's rarely an issue with his throwing, you know. So for a bench player, you talk about a player that makes a difference, I think he makes a huge difference. I think Dave Kilcoyne, because they bring power, they're very good with ball in hand, they're very good technically, you know. So I think for Sean, it's a tough one, but I've no doubt, I don't think it's a point of view that Joe is saying, I'm dropping him because of the last game. I think personally, it was probably in the plan to either go with Rob Herring or to go with Niall Scannell. And, you know, he's got to make a decision then, come towards the World Cup. So he'll give everyone a show. And what that does, that creates competitiveness as well. So I think it's quite smart. I think it's quite tough.
Can we talk about that there, Mike? Because the competitiveness thing, we were chatting about this earlier in the week, by accident almost, 30-odd players have had Six Nations experience now. That was never the intention. It is circumstance that has led to this being treated almost as a kind of, I won't call it development, but it's a strange Six Nations. There's trophy at the end of it, potentially, but nobody really believes that. But two big performances, giving all these guys game time in the tournament, and more to the point, as you mentioned, letting people know that there's no place sacred. You know, we can make exceptions if we want for Johnny Sexton, Conor Murray when they get back to form and are fit. But all of that, like almost by accident, could have a potentially happy ending, couldn't it? Not in the spring, but in the autumn.
That's exactly what I was getting to there. I think it'll pay dividends. I think we're probably having a small bit of short-term hurt at the moment. But I think overall, you know, come the World Cup, we saw in the last World Cup where we lost a couple of players, obviously big names like Paul, obviously, and Peter and guys like this, and Johnny, obviously. But I think if you have a squad that, you know, especially even the year before the World Cup, that have tasted Six Nations, there's going to be a couple of international friendlies. You know, he's using those 35, 36, 37 players to see who his best 30. So what that does is straight away, competitively, it keeps everybody, I suppose, on their toes, performance high. I know at the moment it's dropped a bit, but for different reasons. But I think overall,
long term, it's a good thing.
Long term, towards the World Cup, I think it'll pay dividends for sure. Yeah.
Prendy, just on France, Bernard did a piece of analysis on the French attack on Monday night and against the Head, and it was just funny when you watched their kind of best 2 minutes, so to speak, you went, geez, they're actually playing some really good rugby. And I know there's all the cliches about, you know, which France will turn up and all that. And there's kind of an assumption with that, that there's talent there, but that for whatever reason, it hasn't been allowed to flourish. But from what you've seen on the ground at your own club and also obviously around the league, is that assumption still accurate? Is the talent still there, or is that a myth at this point?
There's massive talent, Wes. There's massive talent in France. You know, there was a good little stat actually the weekend, even from the team that won the World Cup under 20. There was 17 of them involved in the top 14 on the weekend out of a squad of 30. That's quite good going. That's just in top 14 alone, never mind Pro D2. So there's actually plenty of talent. There's plenty of talent underneath.
What's the problem with converting it from underage up at the minute, do you think?
I just think at the moment, and it's actually, it's strange the way it's after panning out, because they're picking the same team. But I know, and I know it's been spoken about a lot at home when we look at the French, just their lack of consistency in everything, in terms of selection especially, you know. So I'm glad to see it's the same team, especially the likes of Dupont and Entomac. It's these guys play with no fear. They're incredibly talented players. There is obviously that weakness that's, you know, there seems to be the word coming out of Mark Cosy. It's obviously not the happiest camp because they haven't won a lot of games or things like they've asked for the team to be announced. You're probably wondering at home, why? How can we know the team on a Tuesday, which is quite bizarre for me as well, especially when you come up against a tactician like Joe Schmidt, that, you know, he's going to pick out those players, that, because a lot of times you won't know the team until closer to the weekend, and you know, you have to hold your trick card, your trump cards or whatever, but to know it quite early is a disadvantage.
Not alone that. Prenti, but I saw he was quite open in saying, well, you know, we expect them to do the usual kicking game. That's our plan to counteract that. Yeah. And our plan is to counteract the possession, suffocating, frustrating game, you know, about keeping...
Yeah, but the thing is, word coming out of Marcosi is that actually the players looked for it. They wanted to know the team on a Tuesday.
Okay.
He agreed with it, so it's quite a bizarre one from the player's point of view. I'm not too sure, but just going back to Wes's question, I suppose talent. You've incredible athletes over here, but spoke about changing the team and turning the team. And you look at the English team that was put out. You've Gael Ficou. It's just an example I give because coach, standing centre in the top 14 over here this season. He's an incredible season. To pick him on the wing, to pick Damien Penault on the other wing, who's traditionally a centre. Okay, he's been playing a bit with Clermont on the wing, but he's a centre as well. So you pick two centres, you leave out, you know, natural 15s, natural wingers. And, you know, when you talk about consistency, that's something. And if they lose, they look to change. So I'm actually, this is the first time I see it that, you know, selection-wise, they've been consistent. It's the first time, I think, in almost a year and a half, they've had the same team.
Is their first consecutive same team named since 2012?
Yeah.
7 years.
But they've incredible athletes. You look at guys like...
Well, the guy at your club, Prendy, that we saw here a little bit a few years ago, McAlow in the back row, brilliant for the under-20s, and then I remember him destroying Munster for Stade Francais, and this guy looked just like nothing I'd ever seen. Like, a guy like that at 19 or 20, if he ended up in, say, a Leinster academy, is there a sense that he would become a more rounded player than what the development pathway in France allows?
Yeah, he's potentially to be a world-class player. Paul O'Connell now, obviously, is coaching forwards-wise. He couldn't speak more highly of him. You know, he's an incredible athlete. He's got everything. He's the quickest back row I've seen play rugby. He's an incredible carrier in space out in the edges. He's a hybrid back row. He's an incredible line-out jumper. He's a great man on the ground. He's got everything. I'm not sure why he hasn't been brought in. Something's happened. He played with France last year against New Zealand, made two massive line breaks in November internationals, and since then he hasn't really got a look in, and it's on everyone's lips over here, not just in our club but everywhere, you know. So but they have those athletes. You even look at guys like Danny Priest, so they're loose prop, Demba Poire, they're front rows that they can move. They're exceptionally good athletes, you know. So
do you know what this is sounding like, lads? It's sounding like in a very simplistic way that, like, if the French squad had Irish coaching, we wouldn't be half as confident. I'm not saying everyone thinks it's a done deal or a banker, but we seem to be pointing out kind of things that are fixable as opposed to the raw talent and the ability to express themselves and the ability to have an intuitive understanding of where the space is. They seem to have all that. It's just the kind of more boring stuff.
Yeah, it's not even coaching, it's more structures as well, you know. That's, as I said, the talent is there. It's frightening how good they could be. I wouldn't be surprised, and this is obviously a bit of a long-term thing.
2023.
They'll bring in. Yeah. You've good young coaches here, like Pierre Mignoni is doing a very good job in Lyon. You've obviously got a guy like Frank Gazzena, who's done a great job in Clermont, And Bernard Laporte has come out recently. He's been asked a question on the local, the French rugby club equivalent TV station, and would they bring in a étranger, which is a foreign coach? And he said, look, I won't shut down anything. So I think they could go that way, whether it could be, you know, an overall Vern Cotter, or especially because he knows the French, he speaks it, or potentially a Warren Gatland, or will they bring in maybe, you know, an attack coach or a defence coach just to have...
Canty Gatland.
Give Joe a year off back in New Zealand and get him back up, you know, there maybe.
That would be a frightening prospect, because obviously, again, he knows the French, he knows the league. And that's the other thing, it's a bit of a challenge with the league. In Ireland, you have four teams that are under one umbrella. So they've, you know, when international rugby is on, those breaks are all designated towards Ireland. Whereas here, like even going back a couple of years ago, when I arrived over here, internationals would play the week before the, you're talking about structures and systems. This
they'd have a league match 7 days out from a test.
And then they'd play the first league back afterwards, whereas now they've had an agreement with the FFR, so they're trying to find medium ground like the RFU in England do. So, in other words, if you get an international on your squad, you're actually, you receive money for it effectively. And
sure,
they have the right for those 45 players on the list.
But Camir, Mike, that's a battle that's going on between all leagues and unions, and we see the World Rugby League, and we won't go down that particular avenue. I won't call it a rabbit hole because it's fascinating and it is the future of the game. So it can't be kind of pushed to one side as just another political spat. But tell me, I think we've enough rugby. What's Hans Peter Wild like? He's the man who owns the club. Have you ever come across him? He's a great name, like.
I have, yeah. He's got a cool name, in fairness.
Bond villain. Would he enjoy a night out in Rashers is the question, Prendy, in Gerard Griffin Street.
He's gone past that, Wes. He's gone past that.
They've Crystal and Rashers, I don't think.
Is that pit that you used to be buried down the back of?
I know, Prendy's an enthusiastic patron of Rashers when he gets a few minutes.
Proper pub.
It's a good plug for my father-in-law, good man.
Camir, is Paul O'Connell so all over him as Hans Peter? Is he his new wingman now? Does he go and have barbecues in his house and all the rest of it?
No, you know what? He's not here that much. He's not very hands-on. He lives in Switzerland. So he kind of comes in and out maybe once a month or whatever, and he leaves, you know, Heineken Mayer, the head coach or the director of rugby, and he's CEO and he's president, kind of run the club, and he's not that interfering, which is quite unusual for a French president. So he's a very approachable, nice man, and I think he's enjoying this little project that he has going.
Exactly, like I suppose, yeah, and he's been into rugby for a long time. He set up his own kind of academy way back before it was fashionable and all the rest of it. He seems to be one of those guys who's bitten by the bug. What's life like there? I mean, it must be fascinating coming across these guys, the difference in cultures and all the rest of it. I know you love your rugby and you'd spend 23 hours a day if you were awake watching it, but apart from that, what's going on? Have you any excitement for us? I know you have a new baby and all the rest of it. Congratulations, so... What's the extracurricular life like? Did you move into Roger's old house when he moved from Racing?
No, I'm just a 2 minute walk basically from where I work in a place called Boulogne, beside Stade Jean Bouin, which is our home ground, and then beside that, which is actually an interesting one, Man United are playing here tonight, which is across the road from me in Parc des Princes. So you've a lovely little outskirt area we live in, and then obviously on our days off, which isn't too much because top 14 is a fair marathon. So it's with travel, and you know, you've a lot of games over here obviously, so when we do, we try and get in as a family into town. The kids are off on a Wednesday, and we go in and do the usual sightseeing spots or whatever. And it's a great city. There's so much going on here. It's a really, especially for, I came from Oyonnax last year, which was a very, very quiet little town. So this is the opposite. And then, obviously, working with Paul and, you know...
How is he, by the way?
He's good. He's enjoying it and he's doing very well.
Is he living there or is he back and forth?
Yeah, no. Not. He lives here full-time. He's about 10 minutes out the road from where we are, and really enjoying it. He's familiar. He speaks, as we're not surprised, tore into the French, so he speaks French quite well already, which is very much.
He's probably on Spanish now at this point, is he?
Yeah, exactly, absolutely. So it's really appreciated by the players and everything. And
sure.
So look, from a social point of view, that as well, you know, and we link up with Donnacha Ryan and when Roger's here, and we go for food. So it's it's a nice lifestyle. But it's, look, rugby wise, it's every coach tell you the same. It takes over. You don't have that much spare time. Actually, this weekend we do, which will be a nice break. We've a small bit of a weekend off. There's no games, so that'll be good. Just to clear the head.
Do you get a sense there? Just like I've always wondered about this, but I know it's different in different parts of the country. But where does rugby fit in the pecking order generally in France? Do you think is soccer definitely the number one sport from what you see with your eyes going around the streets on a day to day basis, or where does it sit?
For sure, soccer is the number one sport here. You know, it's rugby, it's small bit sad. They're very critical here about their national side. Obviously, they haven't been doing well, but I think the general public see the kind of talent that is there as well, you know. So, but from a point of view of where it is in order, it's soccer, especially where, look, in Paris, especially. It's
sure, you'd know there. It's a big difference between Grenoble.
Yeah, Paris Saint-Germain is everything here. It's massive, the soccer, and where's it beside it, so it makes probably highlights it a bit more. But even in terms like Grenoble, traditionally would have been a soccer town, and they went financially bust, so rugby kind of took over. But it did, but it was more of a, we used to get good crowds and stuff, but it was more of an event to go to for people on a Friday night or a Saturday night or whatever, more so than, you know, so. But soccer would be, for me, soccer's on its own, and especially, obviously, in winning the World Cup, you know, it's a game that's only going to grow more and more here, you know.
So where will you watch the match? We'll leave you go after this, Mike.
I'll stay at home. I like to watch them in important games. I like to watch them at home and focus and watch it in my own living room here. So
working.
Enjoy it. No, it's a match we've no games, so I can switch off. And
no, but you'll be still working, won't you?
A small bit, I suppose.
Yeah. Grand, isn't it, getting paid for it? Like. All right, Kabir, it's great to talk to you and hope to see you back here whenever family and career allow. Mike, thanks for your time. Mike Prendergast there joining us. Let's hear from Rob Carney now. He was chatting to Michael Corcoran during the week.
There's a few different emotions knocking around the camp at the moment. We're very excited to get into the weekend. We're a little bit nervous about the outcome. We're nervous of what the French can pose in terms of their ability and their threats. And there's a small little bit of frustration that we haven't quite hit our straps just yet. So, you know, you take all of that into consideration and you've a fair bit going on. But I think the overriding feeling for us has to be that of excitement. We're getting back to the Aviva Stadium in front of our own people, wearing an Irish jersey in the Six Nations. You know, what's not to love about it?
And in terms of the game this weekend, how important was last week? You mentioned the word frustration, that you could maybe work a few things out of your system in terms of building towards this week.
Yeah, I think so. You know, after you've had a performance that you're not entirely happy with, you just want to get back out in the field straight away and get practicing and get training and working on those little bit of combinations and a couple of those individual errors that we all made at the weekend. You want to sort of practice those and get a little bit of repetition in terms of that. So we felt as if we got that up in Belfast over the few days. We trained well again now this morning. We will keep building throughout the week and hopefully, you know, give the best version of ourselves come the weekend.
How important is it that you're not overly hard on yourselves, indeed on each other, that you go back to what you know you can do and what you have done in terms of trying to move forward?
Yeah, I think it's trying to keep a combination of the two of them. You know, we need to make sure that the standards are high amongst each other and that we're still expecting the very best out of each other, because that is what a high-performance environment is. But at the same time, when people do something good and, you know, the team does something good, we need to let each other know about it and encourage and energize too. So I think it's very possible that we can have both of those things seeped throughout our game.
In terms of France, an unchanged team, I don't know if you've seen it, your impressions of them and indeed the danger they can pose.
Yeah, I think it's unusual that a French side has picked the same 15 back-to-back. You know, so it's a sign of the confidence that the coaching staff has in those players at the moment, and it's a sign that how well that they've gone in their last game. They scored 4 tries against the Scots, 2 were disallowed. You know, so we're certainly under no illusions as to the type of French team that's coming over.
There is the possibility, if selected, of a 90th cap for you, along with from Buenos Aires, Argentina, from cap number 1. As a senior player, a senior member of the squad, do you feel almost kind of an added responsibility to help pull people together in terms of making sure everybody is singing off the same hymn sheet and not panicking?
Yeah, yes and no. I think that's where, you know, your experience does come into play a little bit, that, you know, no panic, have confidence in the team's ability, and, you know, you understand that, you know, you can get things back on track very quickly with, you know, a few good minutes of rugby, a couple of good tries, everyone's happy, enjoying their time again, and everything is all guns blazing again, you know. But it's also important that I'm looking after my own shop as well, and if everyone makes sure that their own game is in order and they're not making too many errors and putting their best foot forward, well, then the team will replicate that too.
Michael Corcoran and Rob Kearney. Simon Thomas of Wales Online has joined us. Simon, really appreciate you taking the call. How are you, by the way? I hope everything is well with you.
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Thank you for joining us. I hope all is well with you. We were just going to chat a little bit about the project and the ructions, and I know it's serious stuff, Ospreys and Scarlets, but it does seem to be all over the place. You have a big following online and in Ireland as well, and with your Twitter feed is always provocative and good fun and engaging. Tell me, for people who are kind of coming to this a little bit late, what's going on?
Well, I mean, the background to this is that there's been an ongoing sort of deliberation over the best way forward for the regional game in Wales. It's been titled Project Reset, and that's been going on now for a number of months, and various different options have been looked at. I mean, and the reason for that is the fact that there have been problems in terms of financial limitations within the professional game in Wales, and also, you know, a lack of sustained success on the field. So there's been a realization they have to try and look at maybe some changes, because if things aren't working, then you can't just stay as you are. That was the kind of rationale. Various things have been discussed. We were told that everything was on the table, but it does, over recent weeks, seem to have sort of coalesced to the preference of the new body that runs the Professional Game of Wales, the Professional Rugby Board, PRB. Mm-hmm. As we understand it, their preference was for a new structure, which would be a team in the north, a team in the west, a team in the south and the east. The kind of understanding was obviously there'd be a new side in North Wales, hopefully to the idea being to sort of crack into a new market, which is potential for supporter growth and also maybe public and private investment. But obviously, if you did have a new team in north, that means one of the existing four teams in the south has to go or has to be a merger. So that's where we've been at in recent weeks. And there's been ongoing discussions about potential mergers. There's been talks between the Scarlets and the Ospreys about a merger, talks between the Ospreys and the Blues about a merger. It did seem this week that we are getting very close to the West Wales merger, Scarlets-Ospreys, going ahead. But then I guess, as you might have been following, it's kind of hit the buffers over the last 24 hours. It's been a remarkable couple of days, to be honest.
And, you know, again, it's against the backdrop of some pretty seismic changes in the structure of world rugby and the role of, I suppose, private finance and the relationship between unions and tournament organisers and leagues and their teams. And there does seem to be a state of chassis abroad, and this is just a Welsh iteration of it.
Yeah, with us, I mean, it really does come down to numbers. We are struggling, have struggled sometimes to have four competitively funded sides who can vie with the likes of Leinster, Toulouse and Saracens for the big honours in the game. The budgets, well talked about, the playing budgets in Wales are somewhat less than those of the big Irish and English sides, and certainly the French side. So that's been a big issue. How can we address that? One suggestion has been, if we can't have four sides on really competitive budgets, then possibly we could look at some kind of a graded payment where maybe you have two teams with a higher funding level who would really be able to push ahead and go for the Champions Cup glory, and then maybe having two teams on a more of a development basis. And the Connacht example has been referred to a number of times. I mean, Connacht for a number of years was seen as almost, I suppose, from our perspective, as a development side on a smaller budget than the other Irish sides. And they've kind of kicked on from there. They ended up winning the Pro 12 as it was then. And the hope would have been that those two development sides, which were kind of penciled in as being North Wales and the Dragons, you know, could try and bring in investment, grow themselves and develop in that way. But obviously that's divided opinion as well. But there's been nothing formal on this. And it's only really in the last day that we've started to see, you know, definite statements coming out. And it has got a bit... it's got a bit frisky in Wales in terms of the claim and counterclaim, with the Ospreys coming out with some very strong comments. You know, the PRB, the Professional Rugby Board, responding. Ron Gatland added his voice to the debate. And then in the background, you've got the situation where you've got, you know, a large number of players out of contract, uncertain about their future livelihoods. And also you've got fans concerned about whether their team will still be in existence. Oh, and by the way, we're trying to win a Grand Slam in the middle of all this.
I know. There you go. We think. No wonder we're smug, like, because compared to that, we are wonderful, you know.
Hi, Simon. Just wondering...
Wes Liddy here is producer of Against the Head, our Monday night programme. Sorry for not introducing it properly at the beginning.
Fine. Just wondering, I mean, I know we are a little smug here, or perceived as being a little smug, that, you know, we were very lucky that we inherited a kind of provincial structure, that there was some bit of identity attached to pre-professionalism. And the thing with some of the Welsh regions that we always looked at from here was that, you know, they're essentially made up teams at a certain point, and old club rivalries were kind of, fellas were kind of pushed together almost in these provincial teams. And it kind of seems now, aside from the geographic West Wales reasoning, but the Scarlets have certainly developed that identity and won silverware and, you know, produced a really attractive product in the last few years. And the Ospreys are probably, I suppose, the most established, consistently competitive at the regions. And it just seems like, I mean, reset seems an apt word, because it seems like you're kind of going back on exacerbating all the problems that they had to contend with for the last 15 years again.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, again, it comes down to finance. The question has been whether West Wales can commercially sustain two professional teams, certainly competitively funded ones. I guess the idea has been that if you look at North Wales, you've got 750,000 people up there. There's no other real top-level professional sport. There's a potential of investment, probably from the local government and even Welsh Assembly, possibly private investment as well. So it's seen as a potential growth area. Now, those are kind of, you know, hard-nosed kind of business views on it. But you know yourself, it's difficult to take the romance and the history out of rugby. And as soon as the suggestion of the merger with the Scarlets and Ospreys was mooted, you had fans of both outfits, you know, really upset, really concerned about the future. And I think everything that we're hearing now today is the plan seems to have run aground. It seems to have run aground. And where that will leave us, I'm not quite sure. It might well just leave us with the status quo for a year or two, and no resolution, particularly to the financial issues. But it's just as the original setup of the regions were very difficult and very problematic. This is true. I mean, it's important to remember, you know, why we ended up like we are. You know, you talk about the pre-existing regions, provinces in Ireland. We didn't have that. Mm. But what we did was that we had a financial crisis in 2003, where effectively the Welsh Rugby Union was broke and totally reliant on club benefactors to keep the professional game going. David Moffat, who, you know, the Kiwi with the Australian background, came in to try and resolve the situation. And it was just very difficult to impose what some people have claimed should have happened, like north, south, west, east, but the plan we talk about now, impossible to impose because, as I say, the game was totally reliant on club benefactors. There were legally binding agreements in place that meant that Cardiff and Llanelli could insist on having standalone status. What you ended up with was a real kind of hodgepodge, a hybrid version of it, where you had a couple of standalone sides. You had a merger between the Ospreys and between Swansea and Meath, which said to the Scarlets, a merger between Newport and Ebervale, which led to the Dragons, which Ebervale then pulled out. Or you had the Celtic Warriors, which was a merger between Virginia and Pontypridd, that folded after a year. So it's been a kind of a mess from the start. But there was no other way through it. It was the only way Moffat could get anything up and running, was to have this hybrid. But we've kind of been living with a legacy of that for a long time. But, you know, as I always say of this, it's difficult. It's probably not perfect. But there is a key. There is a key to growth in rugby, and that's success. I remember I used to go and watch cover games in Leinster, Donnybrook in the late 90s, where there were probably a couple of thousand people watching. You, since then, have had 20 years of sustained investment in the Irish provincial game. The IRFU have done a fantastic job. And look where Leinster are now. You know, it's not rocket science. Unfortunately, we struggle in Wales to sustain our teams financially. Therefore, the success is limited. Therefore, the crowds are limited. And round we go in a vicious circle.
And you get 3 Grand Slams, is it, in roughly corresponding period?
This is the interesting bit, of course, because one of the main reasons why the region was set up was to reduce the number of professional teams, to concentrate the talent in smaller sides, to increase the level of performance. And on that level,
there you go.
Rugby's been a great success.
Yeah.
It's been a great success, but I would point again to Ireland. Ireland, to me, shows that you can have both international and domestic success.
Okay. Finally, you know, and thank you for that, and it's improved my understanding of it, certainly, but What about Gatland's comments? It's such a funny world we live in that, like, anything that's indicating national stereotypes now has to come with kind of asbestos gloves, and we've lost a lot of the natural debate that we have about these things, because everybody's filtering themselves. But he came out more or less and he said the Welsh lads are different to the Irish lads because, you know, a lot of them join the armed forces. They're not as highly educated and they know how to take instruction. And, you know, it was cut and dried way of psychoanalyzing a nation, whereas Ireland are kind of more, I suppose, private schoolboy culture, and they'll question and they'll be able to implement a more sophisticated strategy. What did you make of that? Because those conversations don't happen much anymore.
No, I mean, you know, in terms of culture and socially, I mean, it's true in that there is a difference in the kind of background of your average Welsh rugby player. We don't have really the kind of private or public school, whatever you want to call it, fee-paying school, rugby academies here. If you look at the English system, players who play rugby in England quite often tend to come from middle-class, upper-class background. In Wales, it tends to be more your comprehensive school people, you know, coming through. It is more sort of, I suppose, a working class game to a certain extent.
I know, but it's the leap between that and saying these fellas are used to being bossed around by the British class system, so they'll do what they're told.
I'm not sure if we're bossed around by the British class
system. I know you're not.
You know, I think there's quite an independent spirit in Wales still, you know, and but I think that culturally there probably is a difference. But and I think he has found that it's a different kind of type of player to deal with. But yeah, I guess all cultures are a bit different in a way, aren't they, really?
Yeah, for sure. Simon, once again, late notice, appreciate you chipping in for us today.
No problem, that's fine, mate.
All the best, Simon Thomas there, Wales Online. Over to the women's camp, and we're going to join Damien O'Mara again. He caught up with Emer Considine. She had a cracking game against Italy, but the Irish team up against it on Saturday, of course, against France.
I think, like, from the very start, France and England, of course, are going to be the hardest games. But we have them both at home. I know the first game didn't go to plan, but, like, there was a great crowd there, and I'm sure the same will be against France on Saturday. So, we will be hoping for a huge crowd and a huge performance from us against the French, even though they do have a good record coming into Donnybrook. But, every day, every game we go in, we know we can win. We think we can win it, and we'll be going into France the exact same way we go into every single game.
Just a word on that atmosphere, like over 4,000 people at a women's game on an evening in Donnybrook. It was a phenomenal turnout, and despite the result, the way people stayed on at the end, it must be a great boost for you as a squad to see that appetite for women's rugby and that support for this squad.
Yeah, it was, and even though we didn't, the result wasn't there in the end, to have the girls and have, like, the schools and their coaches and all the teams that travelled up from the country stay there and want to meet you for being a rugby player, regardless of winning or losing, it was really, really nice, even though, like, I suppose after the disappointment of losing, it was nice to see that, and nice to see, so the one positive coming out of it is that, like, we are the role models for those younger girls that came from their clubs, that came from their schools with their coaches and teachers. It was really, really good to see.
Does it add a bit of a pressure, though, to try and get a result for this home game to, you know, give people to justify that level of support and those big numbers?
I think the pressure is always there. Every game, home or away, England or Scotland, the pressure is still there to win. The pressure, you want to have that pressure on yourself to perform and to play well. Having a home team, having a home game, the pressure is none, but again, your family, your friends, like, I know my school have a bus going, all my family, all my friends are going because it is our last home game. But these are the days that you kind of want to play for, you want to perform on these kind of days, and you want to play for those people who've supported you from when you didn't even know what Irish rugby was. So you want to, there's pressure, but it's a good kind of pressure.
Overall, how do you assess the performances over the Six Nations in terms of what you guys know you're capable of compared to what it is you've seen from yourselves on the pitch?
Yeah, look, against England, in the end, it wasn't our day. We started off really well. We showed that we could keep with them, but then it was just our mistakes. It was our silly one slip, 1 second, and England are going to capitalise on those mistakes. And similar against Italy, you know, we played well in patches, but we weren't consistent enough, and it was those little mistakes on defence. They just capitalised on those mistakes, and Italy had done well, and they'd done our homework on us, and they were a well coached, and they had a really well improved team. But look, we just have to play for more of it, have the ball for more of it, keep the possession for more of it, and cut down on our mistakes, and we've really been working on that.
No team will ever have a full 80-minute performance, but is the overall message then just to try and inflict the Irish game plan on the opponent for greater spells or greater spells of cohesion than you've managed then so far?
Yeah, like I think we've shown glimpses of really good play in all our games, and like a bonus point win against Scotland was good, and even scoring 4 tries last weekend was good. So we can do. We've shown we can do it on attack. I think we just need to work more on our defence. But like that, we're looking for more than 20 minutes of good play or 40% possession. We are looking to up that. We up our possession and up what we do with the ball when we have the possession. It's our clinicalness when we are inside our 22 and making sure that we do punish teams when we get that far up the field.
How strong are the reviews then, or how honest have the reviews had to be so far?
I think at this level you have to really take a good look at yourself, and like it's the professionalism of it, and knowing that you miss a tackle, it's a try at this level. So, and it's putting your hand up and just not making that mistake again. So like there's no point in sugarcoating it. You miss a tackle at this level, it's going to happen, and there is ownership on that. I think in rugby it's a really good, like even though we are a collective unit and your defensive line is very important as a whole, but individual gaps and individual mistakes are really, really punished here, and you have to acknowledge that and accept it and learn from it.
Just to speak to some of the players after the games and on these media nights over the course of the championship, that okay, the results against England and Italy haven't gone the way that you would have wanted or you would have hoped, but there is still a great sense of positivity, and there's a great view at the larger picture of the players that have come through and perhaps the patience that's required to build towards Rugby World Cup 2021.
Yeah, like people are speaking about us building, like I feel like we've built, we are there, like we have the potential. I think in from a squad we know what we have and we know what we've been doing in training. We just haven't 100% put it out there for everyone else to see, but we know as a squad we have the training done, we have the belief, we have the commitment, we have the skills. I think it just has to happen from now.
So it's just to finish, it's not about trying to salvage something then from the championship. I think like it's 2008 since Ireland finished outside the top three in the Six Nations. Would it be a disappointment if Italy were to pip us to third spot this year?
It would be, yeah. Like we always aim obviously to be up the top there, and if not second, third. We still have 2 games left, and I think we still have a chance to get back up there. And Italy, even though unbeaten going into round 4, they play France and England in the next 2 games. So their record looks pretty good right now, but we aim to turn ours around in the next 2 games.
And how formidable is this French side from what you've been able to scout of them or analyse of them in the 3 games so far?
Yeah, like look, they've had huge performances, maybe flopped a little bit against England, put a huge score line up against Wales, but we're going to look, they've World Player of the Year back again for this game. They're not taking us lightly, and we definitely won't be taking them lightly at the weekend.
Okay, that's Damien O'Mara and Emer Considine. Don't forget that match. I'll give you actually a reminder a little bit later as well, but it's 7 p.m. in Donnybrook. So if you can, get down there. If you can't, you can watch it with us on RTE2, and it's on Radio 1 Extra as well. And before we go, Michael, any final thoughts on a match? You know, which is a fascinating match. Win this, the championship is reset, to use the Welsh region's favourite term. And then we go to Wales, and all of a sudden it's...
All of a sudden we hand England the championship by winning our next 2 matches.
No one cares. No one cares.
No, we're traditional slam busters. We'll take, if it was a slam bust at the end, I suppose we'd have to take it.
But it's that momentum. It's to get the mojo back and to bring back the confidence, which would be a lovely form of confidence, because we wouldn't be as cocky as we were after beating the All Blacks. Yeah. It would be, remember, this is a fragile thing. We're good, but we're not invincible.
Yeah, but we've been saying that now since after the England match. You know, the build-up or post-Scotland was almost... It's post-Italy was almost the same as post-Scotland.
Yeah, it's very boring.
So yeah. Let's hope there is obviously a massive improvement, and they have figured out what...
Will it happen, Michael? Come on.
God, you would like to think so.
Will there be sparks at the weekend? That's what we need, some electricity.
There has to be.
Wes?
No.
It'll be grinding, efficient.
It might be better. I don't believe you can just flick a switch and, you know, improve 100% overnight. But I mean, it's probably more like 10% they need to improve. That's not to say they won't win and they won't perform better. And the sound around the camp does seem better the last few days.
Is that your inner ear telling you that?
Yeah. It's my best self telling me that, whispering it to me. I don't know. It's a funny one, because both teams are maybe in a place where there's a fragile confidence and there's, you know, one or two things fall into place and it snowballs. Equally, one or two things go wrong and there's the weight of their worlds on their shoulders. So, like, for all the talk of it's great the French halfbacks get another game together, they're still kids. They haven't 10 years international experience. So if the game's as tight as people, or potentially as tight as people are predicting, are they going to steer them home?
A big pack.
I wouldn't put my money on it, to be honest.
And the pack is, you know, massive and talented. But even if it performs well, they're pivots, as they say in France. If they're not...
Yeah, Declan Welly has a point in his article about the halfback. So the combined age of Dupont and Intermac is 41, just 8 years older than Johnny Sexton. So that has to tell something. If Murray and Sexton, it has to tell for something eventually. And this is the level it can tell at.
When was the last 9-10 combination in Test rugby that arrived fully formed when they were 20? I mean, it was in a different era. You could say Stringer and O'Gara did, but like...
And they didn't, really.
And they didn't.
It took a while.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it is a big pack. They have a good line out. You know, they make it difficult. Do we start to go into our shell again? They get the tails up. You can see a narrative unfold and that plays out well for them. But all the evidence of the last few years, you'd have to think Ireland will get it done. But whether they're all of a sudden... carving it up, playing, you know, attractive rugby and all the rest. I don't know.
Not till the autumn is your optimistic
assessment. I think, though, if they get the win with an improved performance that sets them up to improve again in Cardiff, then, as you say, you get that momentum leaving the tournament and all's well that ends.
Yeah,
well.
It still has a cup feel to it then,
yeah,
doesn't
the
it?
Yeah, you know? Busting a slam is it does give you a sense of climax at the end of it as well. Like so.
Sure, sure. I mean, because you go over there and perform.
Yeah, and that's, like, even if we're at our very best with everyone locked and loaded, that's a massive challenge
Wales
regardless.
Away.
So yeah. We need the confidence of this week.
A draw match.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Look, France first, anyway. This is the RTE Rugby Podcast. We're going to sign off now. It's available on rte.ie, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever it is you get your podcast. My thanks to Ronan Lawler, who produced with Michael Glennon. And don't forget to catch Ireland-France in the under-20s. We didn't even get around to that. That's going to be a belter on Friday, 7:15 p.m. on RTE2 from Musgrave Park, and full house expected. And the women take on their counterparts, French counterparts, on Saturday, Donnybrook from 7. We're with you from that. We're with you for that at 7 on RTE2 and Radio 1 Extra. And the big game is on 2FM with a 3 p.m. kickoff. And hopefully you'll join us on Monday for Against the Head. Till then, go easy.